Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The Global Story is your new daily deep dive into one big news story. And it's coming soon, Monday to Friday, from the BBC World Service. Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts to find out more.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Rachel Wright, and at 14:30 hours GMT on Friday the 24th of November, these are our main stories. Israel says 13 hostages held in Gaza are being released. The convicted murderer and South African former athlete Oscar Pistorius is to be released from jail on parole. Taiwan's opposition parties have failed to agree on a joint candidate for January's presidential election. Also in this podcast, high hopes that the 41 people trapped under a collapsed Indian tunnel will soon be safe.
These men were dancing to Diwali when they went in, and I promise they'll be home singing Christmas carols. I'm just not quite sure where between now and Christmas they're coming out.
After 7 weeks of relentless Israeli military action in Gaza following the Hamas attacks on southern Israel on October the 7th, the guns fell silent. A temporary truce between Israel and Hamas has been largely holding. And as we record this podcast, Israeli media is reporting that the first 13 Israeli hostages, women and children, have been released and are in the hands of the International Committee of the Red Cross. Our correspondent, Anna Foster, is in the Israeli city of Tel Aviv.
They say that they are on the move towards the Rafah crossing, that they have been handed over. Another of the main TV channels here as well. And of course, remember that the Israeli networks, they have very good contacts, don't they, with people within the administration, within the military, within the government. Another is saying that the hostages will actually come out through Rafah and then will return into Israel through the Nitzana border crossing is one suggestion, which means they would travel a little bit further before they came back in again. You might be able to hear just the hubbub in the background here. People are desperate for the word. They're desperate for the official information. I think as soon as Israel know for sure that they're in a position to confirm this, you know, they will get it out there straight away, because the sense of anticipation, you know, people keep coming around here and they're watching pictures on the screen, that they're waiting to hear what I'm saying, listening to what you're saying, to see if they can pick up any tidbits of information. It's really interesting how many people have come here and gathered, I think, for this moment in the centre of Tel Aviv and in what has become known as Hostages Square. And we know that the government, and they have released certain details about how this will happen, about the way that the hostages will be flown in helicopters from a military base to various hospitals to receive medical treatment, and also to be reunited with their families as well. I mean, think for just a moment, those families who are in those hospitals just now, who know that their loved ones are on the way after having waited for nearly 7 long weeks with no news about their condition, about how they are, even about, you know, whether or not they even survived. And for those people now, these are the last anxious minutes of waiting.
Anna Foster in the Israeli city of Tel Aviv. And a total of 50 Israeli hostages are set to be released over the next 4 days. Israel has confirmed it has a list of names and has been contacting the families. In return, it will release 39 Palestinian prisoners today, 24 women and 15 teenage boys, the first of 150 Palestinian prisoners altogether. The convicted murderer and former Paralympian Oscar Pistorius has been told he will be released on parole on the 5th of January next year. He's been serving a 13-year sentence for murdering his girlfriend Reeva Steenkamp in 2013. The decision to grant parole is controversial. Rob Matthews is a spokesperson for the Steenkamp family. He said they were not convinced of Pistorius's rehabilitation.
My personal opinion is that part of that road to rehabilitation is acknowledging what you've done and being accountable for what you've done and being man enough or person enough to say, yeah, I did it, and all the consequences that go with it. Not just lip service, because lip service is easy. It's easy to say sorry when I've been caught. Your actions have to be completed with deeds in the way you conduct your life. And I think it's pertinent to take into consideration the conditions that have been given to Pistorius. I think that's quite important. Remember, he's not a lifer. He did not get a life sentence. The rules for life sentences are very different.
Nick Miles spoke to the BBC's Daniel de Simone at the prison just outside Pretoria, where Pistorius is being held.
Oscar Pistorius, prior to the crime, was seen as an inspirational figure. He was a global sporting superstar. He had both his lower legs amputated when he was less than a year old, but went on to be a very, very successful Paralympic athlete, winning multiple Paralympic golds, also competed against non-disabled athletes at the London 2012 Olympics. But he then shot and killed his girlfriend, Reeva Steenkamp, in his home on Valentine's Day 2013. The actual details of the case then became really a huge news story for years, really, during the trial and the subsequent appeal, which saw him convicted of murder. He shot her through a toilet door multiple times. He claimed he thought an intruder was in the house. He thought she was still in bed. The prosecution said he knew what he was doing. He was ultimately convicted of murder, and this was his first attempt at parole today.
So he'd been given parole. It's quite unusual for parole to be granted, despite never having admitted to the murder itself. And also the fact that there was a victim impact statement from the mother saying, look, we don't think he's rehabilitated.
He didn't deny shooting Reeva Steenkamp. What he denied was knowing that he was going to shoot her. He claimed that he thought she was still in bed. The evidence was quite complicated, but the Supreme Court that convicted him was satisfied that he was an unreliable witness. He'd given multiple accounts, and that when he shot through that door, he knew that he could be killing someone, whoever was behind that door. Reeva Steenkamp's mother's statement did express a lot of skepticism about his rehabilitation. Also, she expressed concern about that he may present an ongoing threat to women if his behaviour has not been addressed in prison. But she did not formally oppose his release, which may have been a factor in the fact that he has now been approved for release. There will be conditions when he's released. Those include attending therapy sessions to deal with his anger and addressing issues around gender-based violence.
Daniel de Simone. Taiwan's opposition parties, which favour closer ties with China, have failed to unite behind a single candidate to fight January's presidential election. Chaotic last-ditch talks broke down with the two main opposition figures both saying that they would run for president. The turmoil within the opposition camp has improved the chances of victory for the front-runner, Taiwan's current vice president, William Lai, who favours closer ties with the West. And this is of concern to China, as we heard from our Asia-Pacific editor, Mickey Bristow.
It seems on first sight that this is just an internal political squabble, the kind of squabble most countries have, but it has far bigger ramifications, and that's because China considers Taiwan to be part of its own territory and has, in fact, not renounced the use of force to kind of unify with the island. So it looks closely about which candidates win. Now, had the opposition been able to unify and come together under one candidate, then that candidate would have had a better chance of winning. And so Taiwan's future would have been perhaps closer to China. And so there would have been less tension in the region and less tension between China and the United States, because Taiwan is a consistent issue between these two countries, because the United States supports Taiwan. So that's why this election matters. As you indicated there, William Lai, the current vice president, now has a slightly better chance of winning. And he is the opposite to the opposition candidates. He favours the United States, favours more independence for Taiwan. So if he gets in, there's a chance that tension between China and Taiwan will continue for several years to come.
And that's even though Mr. Lai says he favours the status quo, he's not going to formally announce independence. Beijing is still worried.
It is still worried. He doesn't need to really declare formal independence. All he needs to do is position Taiwan as moving away from China. And China sees that as worrisome in itself. And as I said, it's not just a regional issue. It draws in the United States. It means other regional issues are more difficult to solve as well. So really, it's a squabble which, you know, was played out in Taiwan in full view of TV audiences. But it's a squabble which has bigger ramifications and go far beyond what happens just on the island itself.
Mickey Bristow speaking to Nick Miles. The world's biggest iceberg is on the move after more than 30 years being stuck to the ocean floor. A23A, as it's officially called, is almost 4,000 square kilometres in area, more than twice the size of Greater London. It's drifted rapidly in recent months and is now about to move beyond Antarctic waters. Our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos, reports.
A23A is a true colossus, and it's not just its width. This slab of ice is thicker than the Shard skyscraper in London is tall. It carved from the Antarctic coastline in 1986. At the time, it was hosting a Soviet research base. Scientists rushed in, fearing their equipment would be lost, but it didn't move far. Its deep keel kept the berg anchored rigidly to the floor of Antarctica's Weddell Sea. Almost four decades on, and it started to drift, and rapidly. It's not a climate response, just the natural order of things, say scientists. The coming weeks and months will see A23A sweep towards the South Atlantic, where the behemoth will gradually melt and wither away.
Jonathan Amos. Still to come.
There's no thought process. it's just writing some music. I literally went into the studio and I just started to write the symphony.
Singer-songwriter Joan Armour trading on swapping pop for her very first classical symphony.
Every weekday morning, wake up to one big story from the African continent.
Where does Africa stand in this conflict?
How is Africa responding to the refugee crisis?
With me, Alan Kasuja, and Africa Daily.
So what's it like living in an area where Boko Haram are active?
One story from Africa, for Africa.
Our story.
Africa Daily.
That's Africa Daily from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. For nearly 2 weeks now, 41 workers have been trapped inside a tunnel under a mountain in a remote part of the Himalayas in India. A huge rescue effort is underway, although there's been a setback with their main drilling machine. Martha Carney spoke to one of the people running the rescue operation, Professor Arnold Dix, who is president of the International Tunnelling and Underground Space Association.
I'm sitting on top of an evacuation pipe, which is set in the side of a tunnel, which is about 17 metres wide. I'm looking at the place where we're building the emergency tunnels to try and get the trapped men out. To my right is a large crane that's lowering some auger bits and pieces of pipe to push towards where the men are trapped. Immediately in front of me is just piles of dirt and rubble. And to my left, it looks a bit like a war zone or something with just equipment and everything everywhere. We've got, I'd say, at least 50 or 60 engineers and technicians and surveyors and everyone here busy preparing the equipment that failed yesterday. It ripped itself literally out of the mountain, just couldn't do the job.
Are you able to tell me more about the machine, what its purpose is and why it's failed?
You don't have machines designed to burrow their way through avalanches. What you do is you take a piece of technology that's designed for something else and you see if you can burrow through an avalanche. So the particular machine in question is what we call a pipe jacking machine, but with an auger attached. So an auger is like a big meat mincer that goes backwards and it minces rock and then brings the rock back out. And then we push a sleeve of steel around the hole that it creates. And then that becomes a comparatively safe place to effect an emergency evacuation. We've found extreme difficulties getting through the avalanche with any sized material because in the avalanche, between here and where the men are huge machines that have been crushed and debris and smashed beams and rocks and everything else. So technically, the machine, it just couldn't do it. And not only couldn't it do it, it tried and it tore itself literally out of the rock itself and then hurt the tunnel that we were trying to build to get the people out. So we're all holding our breath here at the moment. If it fails, and it's already failed three times, we've got other ways to get inside. They're just going to take even longer. Soldiers are here, as we speak, manufacturing further equipment that we're going to need if we try and mine our way through. That would be if we fail later today with this attempt. All of the people that I'm looking at, including myself, if we're honest, are in extreme danger because the avalanche that's already occurred has already crushed part of this tunnel, but surveyors telling me everything is stable at the moment. I mean, if we have an earthquake, of course, that will change. And, you know, there's lots of earthquakes in the Himalayas, so that could happen at any moment. I've gone up and checked the face, I've gone and checked the crown. I'm satisfied that everything is stable at the moment. We're good to proceed. And we're amongst the sort of the command people here, and there's lots of them. Absolute consensus that we're getting these men out alive. No one's going to get hurt, and that we be careful.
Given all the problems that you've been having, have you any idea now about the timescale of the rescue?
I'm absolutely positive. And from the moment I arrived here, I'm a glass half full kind of guy. Okay, so here comes my assessment. 30 years of rescues and disaster investigations and everything, and I'm saying these men were dancing to Diwali when they went in, and I promise they'll be home singing Christmas carols. I'm just not quite sure where between now and Christmas they're coming out. I think that will be a modern miracle, actually. Like, this is a story I want to tell when I'm an old or older man.
Professor Arnold Dix. Now, venture capital has historically been a male-dominated industry. Men make up the vast majority of venture capital companies and get the most funding. And yet, research from Silicon Valley has shown that startup firms led by women tend to outperform their male counterparts. Nora Bavey is the co-founder of Unconventional Venture, a Nordic venture capital firm which invests in early-stage companies and has a focus on diversity. She told Vivian Nunes about her latest report on how and where venture capital money is being spent.
Year after year, we keep seeing the same numbers, meaning there are barely any funding goers to all female founding teams. And I think what is new now or astonishing across the Nordics, plus Germany, UK and France, is that previous years, we always heard the excuse of, well, women, when they are in mixed teams, they are getting funded. But even that is being really diminished in terms of what the numbers is looking like.
Because you looked at France, the Nordics, the UK and Germany, and in each of those, it was less than 2% of venture capital was going to all female teams. And the situation for mixed teams was not that much better. Take us through the numbers.
This is our fifth report. And what we've seen is that female-founded companies receive one-third of the check size compared to all male-founding teams. Now, what is troubling with this is that when we look at later stage, that slims down to one-sixth of the check size when we compare to later stages. Now, yet again, proving that it is really systemic. But when we looked at mixed teams, what stood out is that the percentage of rounds versus the percentage of the funding were overall more balanced than it was when it were only looking at all female founding teams.
And what do you think is behind this disparity? Is it about the gender makeup of the venture capital funds themselves? Are they less inclined to invest in a company run by women? Is it the products and ideas that the women are bringing to the table and seeking funding for? What do you think's behind it?
What we see over and over again, that actually female-founded companies overperform by 45% compared to male-founded companies. So the business case is already there. I truly believe that this is going back to looking at what it looks like for the last 10 years, even so, is that the percentages aren't changing. We know that there is a correlation between who writes the check and who receives the check. It's not about changing the founders, it's about changing the decision makers. Because when we look at funds that exist in Europe as a whole, we know that 6% of all venture funds are founded by female fund managers. But guess again, they only manage 1% of all asset under management. And we're not listening to the data today that it's telling us over and over again that, you know, diverse founders, whether that's from an ethnicity perspective or, you know, gender lens, are performing better. If we know that, why aren't we funding them better?
And what do you think are the wider repercussions of this? I remember reading a few months ago about startups involving women's health and contraceptive alternatives, and they were finding it incredibly difficult to win funding from VCs. Do you think there is a flow-on effect for what kind of products and businesses are being brought to market because of this gender disparity in funding?
Definitely. And I think we are not seeing problems being solved for the wider community, meaning that male-founded companies within femtech are actually getting more capital at higher valuations than women are within femtech. When we talk about both environmental and social aspects of the huge challenges we are facing with, we now more than ever need more perspectives behind the solutions so we can make sure that the products we're putting out there are actually made benefiting the market as well as the end consumer.
Nora Bavey. Politicians often make footballing analogies to make them sound cool, but a Ghanaian politician found himself in a bit of hot water when he mocked Manchester United's Harry Maguire in Parliament last year. He's now made a heartfelt apology. Isaac Fanning takes up the story.
So last year, you may have seen a video doing the rounds on your social media. It's from Isaac Odongo, who is an MP in Ghana, and he mentioned Harry Maguire, who was struggling at the time for his form in the Premier League.
There was a player in the United Kingdom, in England, called Maguire, who was playing for Manchester United. He became the biggest threat at the centre of Manchester United's defence, tackling Manchester players and giving assists to opponents.
Isaac Odongo has now apologised to the Manchester United defender Harry Maguire for likening government fiscal mismanagement to his performances on the field. I actually spoke to Mr. Odongo and I asked him, what has Harry Maguire got to do with Ghanaian economic mismanagement?
Ghana is a football nation, and coinciding with the World Cup, there was very little interest in the budget. So I decided to find something around football to communicate the fact that I was dissatisfied with the performance of the head of the economic management team, who happens to be Dr. Mahamudu Bawumia, the vice president. And so in an attempt to do that, there was a stray bullet which hits Harry Maguire. And when his form improved, I felt that he deserved an apology.
He's responded to you and he's extended a welcome to Old Trafford. He's forgiven you. Have you seen that? And what's your response?
When you've hurt somebody and you apologise, you genuinely become satisfied that the person accepts it. And I think that that humility and that magnanimity already has made my day, because when the person you've apologised to remains silent, you probably are not able to close the chapter on that. And I thought that this brings closure. But it will be icing on the cake if I'm able to see him play either for England or for Manchester United at Old Trafford.
So Harry Maguire's forgiven Isaac Odongo. Isaac Odongo, though, doesn't sound like he's forgiven the Ghanaian vice president.
Joan Armatrading is one of Britain's most celebrated singer-songwriters. Her many hits include Love and Affection and Drop the Pilot. In a career spanning over 50 years, she's written and recorded 20 studio albums and is a 3-time Grammy Award nominee. Now she's written her first symphony. Its world premiere, performed by the Chineke Orchestra, made up of majority black and ethnic musicians, is on Friday evening in London. Joan Armatrading has been speaking to our arts reporter, Sophie Van Bruggen.
This is Joan Armatrading's first symphony in rehearsal. She wants to let the music speak for itself.
All I'm looking for is an emotion. I just want you to feel this thing that I'm hoping everybody, when they hear it, will feel.
What was the thought process behind it? Why did you think, OK, now is the time?
There's no thought process. it's just writing some music. I literally went into the studio and I just started to write the symphony.
Joan Armatrading came to prominence in the early 1970s.
Now, it's been particularly difficult over the years for lady singers to make an impact here in Britain in the same way they do in America. Thankfully, though, as well as being one of the most sensitive and expressive of all, Joan has broken through.
I am not in love, but I'm open to persuasion.
She's won multiple awards for her music, but has remained staunchly independent, producing and playing every instrument on her records.
44, measure 44.
Conductor Andrew Grahams is rehearsing the Chineke Orchestra in a hall in South London.
It's relentlessly positive. It's this long song of positivity and uplifting feelings.
Do you think it has the ability to live on?
I do think it has the ability to live on. You know, one of the things about Joan's music is that it's very difficult to define. It is classical, but it has all of these elements that are not necessarily classical.
Jane Armitrading says she's lucky that writing music comes easily to her.
I can hear all the arrangements. I can hear the structure. I can see the structure. Of course, even though you hear them, you still have to work out how am I going to play, what's the tune going to be or whatever.
How did you actually learn to score a classical symphony?
Well, I didn't write down the notes, but I played everything. And there's loads of virtual instruments, and you can play all of the virtual instruments on a keyboard. French horns, trumpet, trombone, violin, violas, cello. So I play all the things, so you hear the symphony. To me, it's just like writing a song.
And when you're in that creative process, is there a setting that you need to be in?
I just need to be on my own.
I wanna be by myself. I came in this world alone. Be myself.
I don't know another way of being. So if I were starting now, this is how I'd be.
I'm not the sort of person who falls in and quickly out of love.
But she worries that young people now often have a narrower exposure to music than when she was growing up.
You would hear a classical piece, followed by a Beatles piece, followed by a Frank Sinatra, followed by a Burl Ives, followed by a Led Zeppelin. You'd be exposed to all of these different genres. For me, that was the beauty of radio then, because you didn't have to major in country music. Because that's what seems to happen these days. You major in that particular genre and you never leave it and find something else. I think that's quite sad when that happens.
And at 72 years old, Jane Armitrading has no plans to slow down.
I'm just doing stuff. This isn't like I've done this and now I'm happy and I can die. No, this is just another piece of writing.
Joan Armitrading and the Chinecki Orchestra. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. Before we go, a word on this week's Happy Pod from its presenter, Harry Bly.
This week, we've a heartwarming story about a lifelong regret that's finally been addressed. 77-year-old Mike Phillips from Texas should have graduated from high school in 1965, but didn't because he joined the Navy and served in Vietnam. Now, 60 years on, he's finally been awarded his high school diploma. We'll also hear about a comic book that started in India that's now helping to educate girls all over the world about periods and menstruation. And a cat that likes to spend its time at an English train station that's vying for a Christmas number one. All that and more in The Happy Pod, a weekly compilation of uplifting news stories, in this feed on Saturday.
Thanks, Harry. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was produced by Judy Frankel and mixed by Joe McCartney. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Rachel Wright. Until next time, goodbye.
With the changes to how Canadians are able to access journalism on social media, you'll always be able to find news you can trust on the CBC News app. Get your news without restrictions. Download the free CBC News app today.